Good evening and welcome to the Asia Society. I'm Vishakha Desai, president of the Asia Society, and I'm delighted that you're all here as part of our programming that we're doing during this time of the Asia Pacific Heritage Month. Some of you may know this and some of you may not. Actually, let me ask you, how many of you know the origin of the Asia Pacific Heritage Month? Ah, you don't count. You do. That's pretty good. It actually started in June 1977, and it was Representative Frank Horton of New York and Norm Mineta of California, of course, who then later went on to become senior officials in Clinton administration as well as in the Bush administration. And I'm very happy to say that we have actually had the honor of hosting Norm here in Washington as well as in California for our various programs. But it was both of them who introduced a House resolution that called upon the president to proclaim the first 10 days of May as Asia Pacific Heritage Week. And the following month, a similar bill was introduced in the Senate, and both were passed. Then, on October 5, 1978, President Jimmy Carter signed a joint resolution designating the annual celebration. And in 1992, the official designation of May, the entire month, was really signed into law as the Asia Pacific Heritage Month. And May was chosen to commemorate the immigration of the first Japanese to the United States on May 7, 1843. I thought May was because it was a nice month, you know, but this is important. And it was also to mark the anniversary of the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad on May 10, 1869. The majority of the workers, as many of you know, who laid those tracks were Chinese immigrants to the United States. Over the course of nearly a century and a half, the Asian American population has really come a long way. And today, the Asian American community is one of the fastest growing groups with a population of over 15 million, comprising just about 5.2% of the total U.S. population. And As never before, Asian Americans are at the center of and leading remarkable changes that have contributed to the changing landscape of the American life. And yet, I think that it's fair to say that all is not necessarily well. And one of the things that we want to look at is why is it that number of Asian American communities that tend to have the highest degrees, highest per capita income of any ethnic groups, and yet, when it comes to leadership position, they're not as visible as they should be. We ourselves at the Asia Society just did a survey in corporate America, Fortune 500, and the survey indicated that almost 30% of the workforce in corporate America, Fortune 500, consists of Asian Americans. When it comes to the C-suite, corporate boards, leadership position, guess where is that number? Less than 1%. There's something wrong with this picture of 30% and less than 1%. So we have to look at that. What are the ingredients? What are the ways that we think about this? What can we as Asian Americans do? What is the perception of these communities by others? And how do we put all of those pieces together? So this evening, we're really delighted to have an outstanding group of Asian Americans, many of whom are good friends of the Asia Society, and one who is not is going to become a good friend already. And so each one of them is really recognized as a leader in their own field, ranging from public service, business, arts, and politics. And they will help us delve deeper into the critical issues facing the Asian American communities today. We will also examine the commonalities and differences in their shared experiences and get a better understanding of what really defines this elusive idea called the Asian American-ness. While you have the speaker profiles, let me just point out a few highlights with all of our colleagues. Vijay Iyer is today one of the most acclaimed young jazz pianists. I don't want to say young because you've been around a long time, actually, and a great composer. He has released 13 albums, most recently Historicity, which was named the number one jazz album of 2009 by the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, the LA Times, National Public Radio, and the annual Village Voice Jazz Critics Poll. So you know he's doing something right. The truth is we are very proud because we also had the occasion of working with Vijay to do a fabulous performance that we did some time ago called In What Language, which is one of the highlights of our performing arts seasons of the last so many years. Christina Legdamio is the deputy director of the White House Initiative on Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. And prior to this, she worked for 7 years as in the White House Office for Management and Budget. And Christina, we know that you're relative newcomers to the Asia Society, but soon you too will be part of the family. And we're delighted that you're with us this evening. John Liu, who is the 43rd controller of New York City, was sworn into the office on January 1st this year. And as politicians go, he is the nearest, but it's taking him the longest. So, but you know their budget woes right now, so you can't blame him, and so many cuts are going on and what Bloomberg is doing and the council is doing. So he doesn't have a choice, but he will be here. He's working for all of us, so he doesn't have a choice. Previously, John worked in the New York City Council representing District 20 in Queens, and John was the first Asian American elected in New York City. So that in itself is remarkable. And he was elected both to the legislative office in 2001 and then now in the citywide office as a controller in 2009. And we've had the pleasure of working with John a number of occasions. He's been here numerous times, so it's great that he'll be with us as well. And then we have Mi Moa, who is currently in her third term as a state senator in Minnesota, and she serves as the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Mi is the first Hmong American elected to a state legislature. And she, too, is part of our family because she's one of our Asia Society's Asia 21 young leader. So it's terrific to have you here. Last but not the least is Alice Young. She's a partner and a chair of the Asia-Pacific practice at K. Schuller LLP International Law Firm, where she advises multinationals and entrepreneurs on their business activities and investment considerations in the United States and throughout Asia. Alice, again, has been a longtime friend and supporter of the institution, and thank you very much for taking time to be with us. So before I invite all of our speakers to join me on the stage, let me also just add that there are people around the world who are listening to this program live via webcast, and they can send questions by emailing them to moderator@asiasociety.org. And actually, I should tell you that we already have 5 questions from the web. They're ready to go. They want to know certain questions, so we make sure that we will try to listen to all of you online as well. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming all of our panelists to the stage. Thank you. Please come. We actually were thinking that, you know, they all have things that our friends and colleagues have prepared. And I thought in the interest of time, because we also want to get all of you involved in this conversation, that I would really start with a very simple question. And that is, for each one of you, when you hear the term Asian American, what does it mean to you personally and professionally? And what kind of issues come up for you, as well as ideas that you think really people don't always understand? So we're going to start with you, Mi.
Well, in my world, Asian American, the Asian American identity is very necessary and very needed. I operate in a political environment where I think it's important to default to what are the largest common denominators among the different Asian Americans and Pacific Islander and Native Hawaiian groups and in the United States as well as on the islands. And so I always believe that while we each are very unique in how we celebrate our uniqueness and our individual ethnicities, Asian American is necessary as we function as political Asians. Mm-hmm. And it's really a very loaded political framework where we don't really have a choice. Because the fact of the matter is that it's not an internal identity, it's an externally imposed identity upon us.
Mm-hmm. It's a census that defines Asian Americanness, and none of us have the numbers by ourselves.
That's right.
So there you go. Mm-hmm. So it's the political identity that you think is a very useful and a necessary one to define this notion of Asian Americanness.
And in both from the census aspect of it, but even from the community and from the personal aspect of it, is that we are, whether we choose to define ourselves as, you know, I was born in Laos and, you know, maybe you were born in Korea, at the end of the day, the majority community here often don't distinguish us from one another. So we could choose to fight against that, to say, oh, no, but I'm not Korean-American, I'm Hmong-American. The fact of the matter is that that doesn't really matter to the community outside of the Asian-American community. They will impose that on us. So we either agitate to say, no, I'm really different, or we submit ourselves and give ourselves permission to say, yep, and take ownership of the totality mm-hmm. of the Asian-American community. So my community is the Southeast Asian community. We probably represent the youngest generation of Asian Americans in this country. It's to my benefit to embrace the Asian American identity so that I can take ownership and be entitled to all the political consequences and the political fights that have been achieved by other Asian American communities. So that my community can be entitled to the legacies that have been earned by the Japanese American community, by the Chinese American community, as part of the larger Asian American continuum and the larger Asian American identity.
Well, I think it's useful to remember that, in fact, in the 70s, when this term really began to be very powerful, was out of the civil rights movement.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And it was out of the political public arena that people began to pull things together. So it's not to say that there aren't other identities. All of us have multiple identities. So that's one of the points. Vijay, for you?
Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me. I feel like I'm the token artist. But maybe I'm also the token South Asian.
Mm-hmm. What about me? Excuse me.
No, but you're in charge. I'd said that kind of to make a joke, but also both of those things are kind of new for me. Not just for me, but I feel like for our community, being the child of immigrants from India, our community is pretty young in terms of putting down roots in the United States. I mean, as many of you know, there was a change in immigration law in the 60s that gave rise to a large wave of immigrants from South Asia, including my parents, and that made people like me the first Indian Americans, you know, so people in my generation.
Were you born here?
I was born and raised here, yeah. And, you know, people in my generation didn't have clear precedents to look to for, you know, that person is like me, you know. And in particular, I think because we were new, and also because Asia is so vast and in some ways a fiction in terms of treating it as a unity, it took a while for South Asians to be seen as Asian American, even. So, and I remember when I was living in California in the 90s, people would literally say to me, oh, I didn't know India was in Asia.
Right.
But
well,
even
in California, actually, it's a very important issue because there was a whole group of East Asian Americans
right.
who at one point actually tried to exclude South Asian Americans from being considered Asian Americans. So the census that put us all together mm-hmm. was, in California, was a fight.
Yeah.
This is an interesting question.
Well, I mean, in terms of my own experience as an artist, you know, connecting with Asian American activist groups and arts organizations in the Bay Area, I was an unknown quantity even to them, you know. And they were marginal as it is, and so I was on the margins of the margins. So it was a pretty interesting experience, basically becoming one of the first visible Asian South Asian American musicians in America. That was just, it's not even that I meant for that, I meant to be a pioneer or anything like that. It's just that that was a condition that was thrust upon people in my generation. And, you know, we didn't grow up with Aziz Ansari hosting the MTV Awards, for example, or Cal Penn in the White House, or Jhumpa Lahiri winning the Pulitzer. I mean, that was all, those are all people in my generation, you know, so that's a new thing. We're new as participants in culture and politics. And culture, I think, is that's where it's more visible, particularly now. And to answer the question of what it means for me to be Asian American, partly it means this condition, diaspora as improvisation, you know, as like really having this condition play, imposed on you of having to invent, like at this radical level, having to create a place for yourself in culture. So,
yeah, it's as somebody said one time, that it is more the otherness that you have to deal with as an Asian American that connects us all. Because even to this day, third generation Chinese American from Texas, who I happen to know well, she gets asked, how come you speak English so well? Mm-hmm. Or where are you really from? Mm-hmm. And she speaks with the Texan accent. She has no, you know, so that's one of the questions that we have to really kind of look at too. I'm going to come to Alice last. So, Christina.
Oh, well, I appreciate what my colleagues have already said, because it is a political term, right? And our initiative from the White House was actually established as out of an executive order, which is the highest action a president can take. And it's interesting because the last executive order for Asian Americans was actually EO 9066, which put in 120,000 American citizens of Japanese descent in concentration camps after World War II. Right? And so it was because after the Pearl Harbor bombing, they said, oh my gosh, they're a major threat to our society, let's intern them. So can you imagine if you're serving in the military, which many Japanese Americans did, serving abroad for our freedom, our liberties, and their families incongruently are at home behind barbed wires. And so this, and then you have Chinese Americans going around at that time with pins that said, I am not Japanese, so that they wouldn't get, you know,
interned.
Yes, interned, or just, you know, the prejudice that lives. So we have to understand that this is a counter-hegemonic term, right? That we're going against the hegemony to say we're going to act as a solidarity, as a political group, to come together, to bring more people in office, to bring more people into the arts, into leadership positions, but at the same time, identify us as different.
Yeah.
We're not the same. I am not Hmong. I am not Chinese. Gee, I do speak English, and so do you. You speak it really well. And no, I don't give really good massages, but it's like, you know, all of these stereotypes that plague us as a community because of this invisibility, this perpetual foreigner, all of these ideas that we have to come together as a community and use this term, which is, should involve Pacific Islanders also, to revolutionize our government, our art world, etc.
Thank you, Alice.
And really, to that very point of otherness, the Committee of 100, which is an organization, one of the organizations I belong to, did a survey in 2009 of Americans' attitudes towards Chinese Americans and Asian Americans. And one of the shocking pieces of information, there's a lot of positive information, but one of the shocking ones was that 45% of Americans believe that Asian Americans are more loyal to their country of ancestry than to America. Mm. And this is many generations after the Japanese internment. One would have thought that that kind of attitude had long gone, but 45% of the ordinary Americans. So it tells us that whether we think of ourselves as Asian American, as Asian or not, not only are we considered Asian, but really not necessarily even loyal Americans. I think that's quite disturbing, but it really does explain why we then have to really look at ourselves. Okay, we're 5.2%, which is not a very big group. If we individualize ourselves and say Hmong, Filipino-American, Chinese, we are not even on the charts. I mean, we're below 1%, most of us. Mm-hmm. So in a way, we are forced to describe ourselves as Asian American to get some small piece of the pie, as it were. So I think that identity is put upon us. But frankly, I also feel, being of immigrant parents, first generation in the United States, but born in D.C. and growing up in Maryland, D.C. and Hawaii, whereas either there were no Asians in D.C. when I was growing up, or there were predominantly Asians in Hawaii. So I've seen every kind of, and then I went to Yale in the first class of women, and there were no women, hardly any women, and hardly any Asians. But I think that we found that there was a lot more we had in common and kind of a cultural connection than we didn't have in common. So rice, certain kind of family traditions. The tradition may have been different, but the basic tenets of do well, work hard in school, listen to your elders, take care of the younger siblings, you know, those were all drilled into us. And I think even last beyond the second and third generation.
So some of it may be the immigrant mentality, but then what you're suggesting, there's also a cultural piece that doesn't necessarily
as well as a political piece.
That's right. A political piece, yeah. No, that's very interesting. I mean, I think that this idea of work hard and you will succeed and you'll pay attention to the rest of the family, often people talk about Asian Americans as this kind of a model minority. Mm. And in fact, oftentimes there's this feeling that there aren't really any issues for Asian Americans. We just did a Asian American leadership conference just 2 days ago, and we did a survey in corporate America, as I was talking about, and one of the GE executives said that when they first started an Asian American employee resource group at GE, Jack Welch was the CEO, and he said, why do you need an Asian American employee resource group? You guys don't have any problem. You got PhDs, you got science, you got everything. Why do you need something special? And so this idea that, in fact, there aren't any challenges for Asian Americans in the workplace, let's say. How do you, Alice, think about that issue, especially when it comes to the leadership issues?
I look at it from a lot of different perspectives. One of my non-paying side jobs is that I'm on the Corporate Diversity Advisory Board at Deloitte. They have 30% of their workforce in the United States is Asian American. And yet, less than 1% are partners, which is the top of the heap. You say, why is that? And it turns out there are a lot of different factors. The 30% is a newer number. It was a much smaller percentage in years past. But an example that I sometimes give is for Asian Americans, one of the cultural pieces is that we tend not to say, me, 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 I'm really good, I'm terrific, I'm the best. Just assume if you do really well, if you work very hard, people will notice. That's a Harold and Kumar scenario where they're stuck in the back rooms on the weekends because they're good at crunching numbers. Well, what happens oftentimes is when they say, all right, are you going to, we need someone to present. Who wants to present who's really good? The Asian Americans have a tendency, generally speaking, not to say, I'm the best, pick me. As a result, they don't get picked. So the next time around, they say, okay, who's done a presentation before? We got a new client potential. So, of course, the Asian Americans aren't going to be able to raise their hand. And over a couple of years, suddenly it becomes apparent that in the leadership, in the business development, in the arenas in which you're going to really show your best features and have that so-called ability to become a partner, that you lose, that Asian Americans, not all, but many, tend to lose out, and therefore aren't brought up in the leadership stream. And I find that if you look at law firms, the statistics are not very good for Asian Americans as partners in law firms. If you look at judges, we have, I think, 5% of the population are in the legal field, and yet there, until Denny Chin was very recently confirmed, there was not a single, out of 175 appellate judges, there was not a single Asian American across the country. How can that be?
No, and I think that this comes up again and again, that the idea that Asian Americans feel that if I'm good at my content, I've gotten good grades, people will notice me, that I shouldn't have to do more. But the other piece, as some people have pointed out, is that as a result of other skill sets that need to be developed, which is about building teams, growing leadership skills, also unless some special attention is given to those, we found that best-in-class companies actually do specific leadership development skills for Asian Americans, and therefore you see many more Asian Americans moving mm-hmm. forward. What's your sense of this idea of the model minority and where that comes out?
Well, certainly I think that it's an absolute advantage in some way, and it's a disadvantage in some ways. I think that at the corporate level, at the level where Alice is talking about in terms of corporate leadership, some of those dynamics are very obviously there. But when you trickle it right down to the grassroots level, when it comes to an issue about, you know, resource allocation and how you really provide services, we see the model minority myth about how Asian Americans have it together, really having some of the most disparate impacts on the Asian American community as a whole. You know, I'll give you an example. In Minnesota, in the 80s, 90s, and the early 2000s, Asian Americans was part of the group of the communities in the communities of color that had the highest rate of home ownership. Mm-hmm. But as a result of the downturn in the economy and with the mortgage foreclosure crisis, that population has become one of the largest population that has been affected by it.
Really? Why is that?
Because many of them are multiple income earners living in a home, cobbling together enough income and resources to be able to pay the mortgage and to live where they're living. And all it takes is for one of those incomes to go away, so somebody losing a job or two people losing a job, and they can't afford to maintain the mortgage to pay for the home. But for the Asian Americans in Minnesota, there's a tremendous sense of wanting to plant, to put down their roots, to own a piece of earth so they can dig their garden in the back and grow their vegetables and not have to deal with a landlord who won't give them permission to grow their vegetables. So there was a tremendous desire to want to own their own home. And yet that now is the population that is, you know, experiencing some of the highest rates of mortgage foreclosures. But if you look at the dollars that have come into the state, and I think that we will hear this from our colleagues in Washington, D.C., who are monitoring this all across the country, is that Minnesota is not an anomaly in that if you look at the foreclosure counseling and the foreclosure prevention dollars that have come to among all the states, the one population that has received the least attention and the least assistance with these dollars has been the Asian American community. And in part because I think that for some reason there is a perception that maybe they don't need it. Maybe a lot of us are really proud of our ability to do this on our own, cobbling together multiple incomes. And when we hit shaky economic grounds, we retrench and we don't want to go out. I mean, how many of us will willingly pick up the phone and call a mortgage foreclosure and say, we don't have enough money, and we're losing our home?
But it's the whole shame issue is so big culturally.
It's totally. Yeah. And there's not been an effort on the part of, I think, direct service providers to aggressively and assertively come out to our communities to give them permission. So it is the job of government to do this for you. Do not be ashamed. And because there's not been that intentional effort to target our communities,
have been left out of federally funded and statewide funded programs that are supposed to go to all the citizens in our states. And so,
Christina is listening to this, right?
She's not. I mean, the White House initiative is exactly that. Mm-hmm. The disparate impact of on Asian Americans and resources for healthcare is so dramatic. You know, we are the one population that has some of the most alarming statistics with respect to mental health and mental health care. And yet it is absolutely not on the radar screen of anybody to ask Asian Americans and to take that factor into consideration. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's terrific. That's kind of mind-boggling, right?
Yeah.
I'm gonna cry. I want to cry. I mean, to see all the resources and to know that it's not reaching the people that I care about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it also is because we had no political clout. We had and we had no way of figuring out how to get attention paid. I think that is changing.
Right.
That the banding together of Asian Americans, recognition that working together we can get more done than working separately in our own communities, really has now propelled, I think, a greater effort. And I am so proud and pleased that there are more and more Asian Americans like you in political office, because I think we need that kind of visibility in order to make ourselves heard and not have people have the more standard expectations that Asian Americans will help each other, will help themselves, that, you know, it's all right, don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. And I think we do have to be a lot more assertive, which certainly my parents' generation absolutely refused and were afraid to do, and perhaps with good basis. I mean, they came in during the McCarthy era and, you know, the Japanese internment and whatnot, so there were a lot of things to be afraid of. But I think even now, we really do end up having to be much more assertive than many of us are comfortable with. I mean, I found starting in law practice that even though I had the Yale and Harvard credentials, people would kind of look at me and say, what? Are you really a lawyer? You know, where are you really from? That kind of thing. And it really took a tremendous amount of energy and almost just girding up and saying, okay, I can do this, and really pushing out beyond my comfort zone of saying, all right, I can do international work. I can, and I think that's very hard. But unfortunately, I think even now, so many years later, I've been practicing law for over 35 years, I still see that we need that push to become recognized.
That's that kind of unique emphasis that and work that needs to be done, that is not just going to be done by osmosis unless we focus on it. And I keep saying that it's always the American issues and the American experience, us being here, that unites us. So it's the immigration issue, it's the mental health, it's a political process. All this is about being in America.
True.
That's where we have to come together.
Yes.
Cultural heritage-wise, we might say we have different heritages, although I personally think that we as Asian Americans don't do a good job of learning about each other. I always say that when we do an Indian program, we have all the Indian Americans come up. When we do the Chinese program, all the Chinese Americans come in. I say, well, how come you're not going to each other? What is this, you know? So speaking of which, Vijay, I wanted to talk to you a little bit more personally, because often the model minority myth for Asian Americans, whether it's Chinese, Indians, or anybody else, they're doctors, scientists, accountants, you know, all of that stuff. And here you come along and you're a jazz pianist. So how did your parents think about this, first of all? And secondly, how did that fit into how you pursued your own life as a creative person?
Well, I've been asked that question so many times about what my parents thought. You know, I'm often asked that by fellow South Asian Americans, and it's usually
the first thing they usually ask me is,
do you do this full time? And then they say, well, what did your parents think? So I think it just speaks to the fact that this is so new in our community that we suddenly seem to be permitted to participate in culture. I mean, it's really it took some doing, you know, to establish that basic truth, you know. Well, I spent, as maybe anybody who's read my more extended bio knows, I spent time trying out several other things before settling on a musical career. That my undergraduate degree was, much like John Liu, I just found out, my undergraduate degree was in mathematics and physics.
You're and, not alone. You know, there's another filmmaker who is from Taiwan, and he desperately wanted to be a filmmaker. And his father said, there's no way I'm going to pay for you to go become a filmmaker in America. So first you have to go and do it. So he becomes a physics PhD.
Yeah.
He goes back to Taiwan, gives his father the degree, and said, okay, now I'm going to go and do what I want to do. So there
you
are.
Well, I mean, in my case, it was more, I didn't know if I had anything to offer as a musician at that time, because there weren't, I mean, I just wasn't on anybody's radar as a musician. I was taking violin lessons and kind of playing piano by ear and didn't have any sense I was any good anyway. But I knew that I loved music, but lots of people love music, you know. It was more that when I, you know, so I did this whole undergraduate in the sciences at Yale, and then I entered a PhD program in physics at UC Berkeley. So I was really ready to go on this track to sublimate. And eventually, you know, basically as soon as I set foot in the Bay Area, I started playing out a lot, doing a lot of gigs, and things just started happening for me as a musician. So I, for a while, had this kind of classic double life where I was, you know, physics grad student by day and musician jazz musician by night and so on. And eventually I just realized where my heart was, you know. And the idea that I think the American dream of self-actualization was just, it was just new to us, honestly. Like certainly my parents never, I mean, they came here and that was in a way their self-actualization. But I don't think that there was ever this sense like you do a career for yourself.
Right.
You know, it's really more you do it because you're investing in a much larger set of priorities that have to do with your family and so forth.
It's about doing well, not so much self-actualization.
Doing well, right, but not necessarily doing it because you love it or for yourself in that sense. And so, in a way, I had to sit with that for a while. Like, would this just be an indulgence? And plus, what if I fail on top of that, you know? And, I mean, for a while, I kind of negotiated things in parallel. And I left physics, but then I actually was able to create my own PhD program at UC Berkeley in technology and the arts. So as you see, I was just slacking off. But at the same time, I started touring and performing and making albums and leading my group and so on. And
how did your parents think about this transition?
When I told them that I was leaving physics, it was hard on me. You know, because I, at this time, I was 22 or 23, and I had spent 6 years, which was more than a quarter of my life, working towards this thing that I was now seemingly going to abandon. So that was hard for everybody. I mean, it was a bit traumatic, I think. And I remember, you know, there were tears, and my mother cried, and so on. And I think also it took a while for me to really make clear what I wanted to do. And in a way, this other PhD that I ended up getting was kind of, it was partly, it wasn't that I did it for my parents, but there was some version of them acting as my superego, kind of encouraging me to at least finish what you started. Yeah. So, and I get, you know, I'm proud of the academic work I did, and I wrote a dissertation, and people cite it, apparently, so. So it wasn't a complete waste of time, but it was very much subordinate to my artistic career, and not just artistic career, but artistic life, because that's really what it was to me and continues to be. In a way, the career is just a bonus, but the fact that it's my life is really the main point. And that, I think the fact that I've been doing it now for what's 15 or 16 years, and it's added up to something. You know, it's what I've been doing. It's the only thing I've done for the last 12 years, and you know, my parents can see that it's added up to something. Mm. That I have a, you know,
did they like
can,
your
they
music?
Can show pictures of me in the newspaper to their friends. And also, and my father, especially, both my parents like the music, and my mm-hmm. father especially has had a nice kind of, in his retirement years, he's kind of come back to music in a way. It had been part of his life very early, and I think for him to kind of re-experience it because of me has been very rewarding for me.
Mm-hmm. That's terrific. I think this idea of self-actualization, it goes back to how Asian Americans don't really stand up for themselves necessarily, and that it takes a while to kind of get over there, you know?
Yeah, and I'd say that idea, that issue of standing up for yourself is still, you know, or just sort of being a self-promoter is just something I still find a little unsavory. But I suppose it depends who you talk to, because some people see me as like the biggest self-promoter. So I think it just has to do with, you know, what it takes to, I mean, what I tell a lot of young people who want to be musicians or want to be in artists or in this area is that, you know, obviously most of the work is about the art itself, but then there's also a certain, I wouldn't even say it's self-promoting, but it's just more like, do you have a stomach for the game side of it, like just the business side
it's
of
tough.
It, which is just,
it's tough.
It's nauseating is what it is. And it's basically, it's not something I'd wish on anybody. But if music really chooses you, which is what I feel happened with me, then everything else just happens, you know. Well, ideally, that's how it works.
I think what's interesting is that within the context of the Asian American experience is that idea of fear of failure.
Yes.
Not just for yourself, but for your family. And, you know, how do you do that? Whereas as an artist, you don't have a choice because you go out there and, you know what?
What I'd like to tell all Asian Americans is once you get used to failure, it's not so bad.
Christina, in terms of this idea of a model minority and where you come out, especially in the White House, but even in your personal experience, now in the Obama administration, there are lots and lots and lots of Asian Americans. This idea of a model minority and what it brings as a mixed blessing, how do you look at it within the context of your work at the White House, but also with other young Asian Americans? Because it's not only that there are a lot of Asian Americans in this administration, but a lot of you are really young. My gosh, pretty amazing to me. Yeah.
Well, I have to say that even though I'm in the White House, my mother still wants me to go to medical school. So, you know, something just never, the dream never dies. And that's just something we have to accept. And it's really refreshing to be on this panel where there are different, you know, people representing different fields, even though you're perpetuating the myth with the PhD in physics and our person, John Liu, who's good in math, obviously, as our comptroller. But anyways, so the stereotype is alive and well, and it's up to us to debunk that, right, and just to have people like me to come out and be very vocal, and so they can see that, oh, wow, Asians aren't just quiet, and they are going to speak up, and we have to be careful and not step onto those and be cognizant of this group. But it is alive and well. And I, even though you all are here, I know race is very much on our minds, you know. And it's you, even though you're very diverse, all of us, you know that when you go to a party and then afterwards you'll go home and you'll be like, but hon, what was she? Was she Hapa? She must have been mixed something. And it bothers you, you know? And it's really on our mind. We want to know what is the racial identity. Right. And so we can put you in this category and say, oh, that, no wonder she's like that. No wonder he's a good pianist, you know, but.
So, or not.
Or not. Thank God it's jazz pianist, right? Not classical.
But, you know, it's very interesting, actually, that idea of people talking to you. I mean, I've had
right on Park Avenue in some distinguished homes, and number of times at a party, and people would say, you know, when I was in your country, oh, it was so wonderful, this and that. And then I finally have now learned to say, actually, this is my country, too.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly.
I mean, it's not that that is not my country, but this is my country, too.
Right.
I happen to carry an American passport, you know.
Right.
So,
and it's, you know, this is, it's institutionalized. It's part of our thinking, you know, and it's something we have to unlearn consciously, you know, we have, and so this is what we have to tell folks in government, that no, we're not all smart and, you know, young and, you know, play the piano well, but, you know, they're actually Hmongs who face a 44% high school dropout rate. Pacific Islanders are not going to college. We have a high poverty rate among Southeast Asians. It's this education that we have to do within the government, because they think, as Mi said, we don't need the services. And also it's the education we have to do within ourselves and our own communities, our parents, and say, yes, you need to go up and ask for SSI benefits because that is your right. That is why you became a naturalized citizen, to get these protections, to have these freedoms. And so it's this ongoing struggle that we face, but we hope, like, with something like the R Initiative in the White House, it brings these issues to the forefront so that it's on people's minds, you know, and you're seeing us also, right? Thank God, not just in these stereotypical roles, but it is really changing the way people, I think, America sees Asians.
I do think it's up to this generation to switch the thinking somewhat, because when you say it's our right, in most Asian countries and Asian communities, the idea of it being an individual right is not the strongest piece. It's what is best for the community, what is best for the family. It seldom is what's best for me. And I think we've continued generation after generation, even in the United States, fourth generation, still kind of feel a little guilty if we're doing it for ourselves, for example, and not for others. So there's still that sense of not asserting rights, but rather sort of thinking about what might be best and how do we kind of fit into that. So it's really this coming generation that I think will be able to assert, in a sense, rights that are deservedly so, and also be a little more creative, to have the ability to do other things, to think out of the box. I mean, I did what was very traditional, although frankly my parents, who are very traditional, thought that lawyers are shysters and that basically the fact that I went to Harvard helped, but they really had hoped that I would get a PhD and teach, and were not happy with my being a lawyer. But I think this generation, and my daughter is here tonight, kind of laughs about this when she said, you know, I'm thinking of being a lawyer. I said, why wouldn't you want to do something more creative? I worked so hard so that you could do something creative. And yet I think we're also a little afraid of that, because what is the future? It's a very unclear future. So I think we have very mixed feelings about it, and it's really up to this next generation of Americans of Asian descent to make inroads. And what's wonderful, I think, now is because we've become a much more global community, there are fantastic musicians and writers and artists, actors and actresses from all over Asia who are making an impact in the United States also. So it's not just Bruce Lee, but we actually have Asian Americans in the United States, and we have Asians that have created this sort of global community.
I
mean, and so I'm very excited about that.
I mean, I do think that we mustn't forget that right now, close to 77% of people of Asian origin are foreign-born, which means that it's still a young population in terms of immigration, and that part of that notion of belonging now becomes much more complex in this global arena, where people are, what they do, how they go back and forth, which also creates some confusion for people, because that is not the typical immigrant experience.
Right.
It's not just here or there. And I was going to ask you, Christina, in terms of your work, What do you face as the biggest challenge in the White House initiative that you guys feel like this really needs to be tackled?
Mm. Well, it's interesting because we have such a supportive administration right now that the work is very much supported. So, for example, in the Gulf right now, the oil spill by our friends at BP, it has actually affected 60,000 Vietnamese and Cambodian Americans, fishermen. So 33% of the boats that were on the Gulf are owned by Vietnamese Americans. And people don't think about that, right? Because they're just thinking about, oh my gosh, the, you know, of course, the environment and all these other issues. But how are these fish, they were just recovering from Katrina. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, they were so ready to get their boats back out and to rebuild their lives, and then this happens. And this is actually probably more long-term. And so the whole industry is probably going to fall and collapse. And so how do we help them? They're going to have to find a whole new trade or leave. And so,
but they don't know anything else.
They don't know anything else. And they're not totally fluent in English. And they have low education. So how do we get them into services? Mm. But all these groups that are out there, you know, the federal agencies are giving them flyers. They're all in English. BP is talking to them and really taking advantage of them and not helping them with their claims, and they don't understand what's happening. So we actually have someone on the ground there helping to raise awareness, and it is because this administration is supportive that we can be down there to do to provide direct service to this community that otherwise would be overlooked. So I think we have, there is hope, and with people in prominent positions, I think we could just continue that hope.
Which is great. Speaking of Vietnamese and the fact that here they are, they're sort of young immigrants in a way, if you will. So we as a country are facing a pretty significant issue around immigration, considering what's happening in Arizona. And if Arizona law continues to be something that people paid attention to, and the fact that the statistics show that 65% of Americans are in favor of what Arizona is doing, how do we, and you know, from the law side, but political side, how do the Asian American communities actually deal with the immigration issue? Because it seems to me that other than H-1B visas, Asians have not actually come in to this discussion enough. And yet, if you look at 77% is an immigrant population, foreign-born. How do we look at this issue as a community? And me, you might have some thoughts, and I want to really ask each one of you.
I think that a lot of the political rhetoric around the Arizona-type legislation, you know, I represent a northern state, and I often tell my colleagues in the legislature that it is amazing that we're a northern state with one of the largest borders to Canada. But whenever we talk about immigration, we talk about it as if, like, we have a southern state mentality. And it sometimes it takes something like that to make you realize that, you know, all the political rhetoric around immigration and immigration reform has symbolically taken on a southern border mentality and southern border implication. How does it affect the Asian American community? That kind of southern border mentality has become, I think, the symbolism, the symbolic enemy of all things perceived to be foreign and therefore threatening to the sense of security and an easy target for the unleashing of people's anxieties when they're feeling vulnerable. So I see that every day in Minnesota. And when I go to the Asian American community, or more importantly, when I have an opportunity to interact with my brothers and sisters in the African American community, when there's a perception that, well, this is a Latino issue, I say to them, it may be a Latino issue in its creation and its political rhetoric, again, the southern border mentality, but we all, as a collective community of color who are perpetually be thought as foreigners, will feel the consequences mm-hmm. and will live the adverse results yep. mm-hmm. of those type of political rhetorics.
Absolutely.
And that's where I think that as an Asian American community, as an African American community, you know, as a Russian immigrant community, I mean, the state of Minnesota has become so very diverse in the last 10 or 15 years. And so I've had ample opportunity to talk to the various immigrant communities about this issue and why it is highly critical that as different immigrant populations, we must take ownership of this conversation about the immigrant immigration reform and immigration debate because it will have a direct impact. Mm-hmm. If as a result of Arizona-like type legislation and mentality, we now have to have people prove citizenship in order to mm-hmm. get public benefits, Russian immigrants and Russian senior citizens will be affected by that. Mm-hmm. Asian American immigrants and Asian American citizens, seniors will be affected by that. And so the debate may have a different face and color to it, but the adverse consequences will be felt by all of us.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I think you've pinpointed, and I think that is why it is really important to rally around this issue and have a voice, because it affects racial profiling, affects all of us, not just Asian Americans, but our entire country. If you have Muslims who are being picked off, or those who are wearing turbans, or you know those sort of racial qualities, which then mean that people are hauled off of airplanes and whatever, we lose our freedoms mm-hmm. as a country, mm-hmm. not just as Asian Americans or African Americans or Muslims or Sikhs. It's really, as a country, we start becoming the other.
Right.
We become less of a democracy. And I think much better of our country than that.
Yeah.
And I think that it is, however, Asian Americans are still a very small group. And we're the only ones that were really incarcerated. And the Japanese Americans were truly American citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And that was allowed. So there's a good example of when there is a lot of fear.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States, a lot can happen that we would subsequently regret.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important to band together with, we're too small a percentage,
mm-hmm.
To band together. I think Jewish Americans have quite a few organizations that really do go after discrimination. There are lots of African American groups, and we really need to also learn to work together to show that this is an issue that isn't just affecting one or two small communities.
Right.
It's really affecting our American way of thinking and our beliefs,
mm-hmm.
And that those core beliefs are being questioned. Aside from all the other obvious advantages of having a better, a more open immigration policy, I mean, we have benefited this country from being a nation of immigrants. Some of our
best and brightest
have come from other ancestries.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been the foundation, really, how America
and how
thrived.
Ironic it would be that here in the 21st century, in the first decade that we finished, when the world is becoming smaller and more interdependent, and when other people look to us saying, you have an advantage,
mm-hmm.
that you have people from all over the world coming in here, would be exactly the time when we might try to close that off, to become isolated. So the very advantage we have as a country,
mm-hmm.
we would turn it around.
Mm-hmm.
And this must come up all the time.
Yeah. I mean, we always say we are a nation of immigrants. We are all immigrants or descendants of immigrants,
unless you're Native American,
or Native Hawaiian, or you know, brought over as slaves. But you know, we are all descendants of immigrants. And so, but this is the human condition, right? That there is always an other and there's always someone at the bottom. And I think we have to educate within our own community, because you can even see within Asian Americans, the younger generation, like I remember in college, you know, you would have the foreign Asian Americans who are like speaking a different language and you disassociate yourself from them. You're like, I am American, you know, and you speak loud in English so that people know you're American and not a foreigner, right? So there's that happens within our own community where you don't want to be the other. And so there is that even kind of self, that discrimination going on.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that within, it's a class issue, right? So
mm-hmm.
as you become more assimilated, you want to show your Americanness. and that you're not from a different country. And so I think there is a lot of education that has to be done within our country and then at the policy level, right? So that people know our history and the history of immigration. That if you look, yes, stereotypes are based on a truth. And yes, there are many smart Asians in America because they came in 1965 or during this, when we had immigration policies that said only a certain class could come in. And then, but if you look post 1965, post 80, with more refugees coming in, it's a totally different population. We're a very diverse community. And people don't do that analysis, right? So they just clump us all together.
That's so true. We're going to open it up to all of you. So let's take a question from you, and then I have some questions from our online audience. So I think the one thing we should say, John, we know you had very important job to do, which is to fight the budget battles, right? I really appreciate the fact that you actually came. This is actually a good time. We are in the question and answer period. One of the questions we have from Josephine from the online audience, and she says that the more we create boundaries among ethnic groups, the less assimilated we really will be. Americans are Americans. New Americans face certain challenges. But I argue these days that it's more economic and perhaps linguistic obstacle, not a race issue. She wants us to reply, but I would like you to just take this and see in your experience as the first Asian American elected official in New York City and now as a controller. Does this ring true for you that it's not a race issue?
In the political race?
The answer is no, it does not ring true for me.
Right.
That this is a couple of double negatives in there. Right. No, exactly. It does not ring true that it is not a race issue.
Right.
First, let me thank you, Vishaka, and the Asia Society for putting this forum together. It's a great turnout that we have here tonight. I apologize for the delay in getting here, but I think given the distinction of my fellow panelists, I think they certainly did very well, and I know a number of people from my office watched it online, so we were participating as well. Great to see Senator again. We've been together on a number of panel discussions in the past, and we share a lot of common views. So I may not actually be contributing that much because the Senator has already done a yeoman's job. To answer the question, I think race is an issue. It's not an issue that we make.
Right.
You know, when I was growing up here in New York City, and this is supposed to be an international capital of the city, of the world, I didn't go out there and say, hey, I'm Asian. Other people pointed out to me the fact that I'm Asian. Okay? So growing up here, I was constantly reminded of the fact that I'm Asian.
Yeah.
So while we could say, I think in a perfect world, we don't get identified by any of these overt traits. I mean, you can't, beyond the first micromillimeter of our skin, you can't tell, right? At the end of the day, we're all people, but it is a phenomenon that I think, I mean, I didn't have the privilege of hearing what Vijay and Christina have had said. I know what Alice and me have said before, but I feel like, you know, this is not something that it's not an issue we force. It's growing up here, it's always, at least from my personal perspective, it's been an issue that's been forced upon me. So given that, there's a reason why we have May, as the many presidents have pronounced May to be Asian Pacific American Heritage Month or Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month. It is because as a group, we have certain struggles that have some distinction from other groups, and that the challenges we face today as APIs are somewhat distinct from others. So we have a lot of commonalities, and as time goes on, there will be much more we have in common with other communities of color and then just with the so-called mainstream society. But right now, we do have struggles. We have had struggles, and those struggles are not over, and that's why I think there is an Asian American identity that I'm certainly proud to be part of. But growing up, it's not something that I went out there and pushed. It's what has always been pushed upon me.
Exactly. We'll take a question from the audience again, and then we'll go back to online.
My name is Indrajit Saluja. I'm editor of the Indian Panorama. And this question is for our senator here. You have been taking up immigration issues in a big way right from the beginning of your career. And the two issues that were thrown up today were the foreclosure and immigration. I'm opting for the latter. Given the Arizona legislation on immigration, in order to protect the interests of the illegal immigrants, some of the cities have tried to issue some kind of identity letters or forms, whatever you call it. My question is, will that protect them against FBI action or the action from the one, Homeland Security? Two, just now it was said that we have to band together to protect the interests of the immigrants. I'm not saying legal or illegal, I'm saying immigrants. I would like you to elaborate on that, particularly with reference to the 13 million people that are illegally living in this nation. Thank you very much.
Well, I think that legality or illegality is a political construct in terms with respect to the people who live in this country. If you look at the history of how Americans, all of us, came to be here, at different points throughout the time, different definition of who is legal and who is not legal has been imposed depending on what the political flavor of that time was.
Including
Jim Crow, of who is a legal American and entitled to the full benefit of being that. The Native community, when you go to Indian country, there's a question about whether or not outside of reservations where we've chosen close them, that there are truly legal Americans. So the idea of who is legal or illegal, I think it's a political definition for purposes of governance, right? And so we have to submit ourselves to that. I'm a state legislator. States should not be put in a position to have to implement federal law. As a nation, if we choose to make some distinctions or if we choose to decide how we're going to regulate the inflow and outflow of people into this country, then we should do that as a matter of national policy because that's the right and the duty of the federal government. But as a state senator, it is my job to protect the residents who live in the state of Minnesota and to ensure that the resources that go out to the residents are equally accessible and equitably distributed to the people who live in my state. And likewise, I think that the people who function at the local government level would say exactly the same thing. So there are a number of different arguments here about, you know, whether or not it is the duty and the right of cities and state governments to be implementing federal law enforcement policies. I think it's not. The federal government needs to take care of its obligations of how it chooses to regulate instead of pushing this obligation onto the local level. That being said, I think that it is absolutely a moral issue that immigrants, which means all of us, regardless of whether you're a person of color or not, take this issue on as our issue and own it. Except for the Native community, not a single person living in this country is entitled to call anyone else a foreigner and therefore not entitled to be here. And that while this veil, this artificial veil of making some people legal and illegal is giving people permission to act in ways that are so foreign to who we are as peoples who ought to care about each other, people often don't think about the fact that many of the same people who make the arguments that these illegals should not be here are taking benefits from the work that they do every single day. And so, you know, we just have to be honest about this. Whether we're going to be a country about peoples and celebrate that, or we can choose to use political instruments that are available to us to continue to separate us as a people. And I choose to be on the side of being an American And to be an American is to say every single one of us, whether we came in the 1800s or we came in 2010, we're all Americans and fully entitled to the benefits, the obligations, and responsibilities of living in this country. And until the federal government decides how they're going to deal with this issue of who's legal and who's not legal, so long as you live in my state and you live in my city, you deserve my representation equally as any other person, regardless of the status of your documents.
Ooh, that's pretty powerful. Well, there you go. Now, since John was not asked this question, but since you are another elected official and you represent the White House, I want to know whether you feel the same way.
Yes.
This is New York City. There you go.
You know, it's. I mean, I think me already said it best. I would maybe add a little context to that. This, you know, what's happening in Arizona, I think, unfortunately, is somewhat predictable. How long have we been waiting for
action
at the federal level? It's years overdue. There was a great deal of expectation, let's be honest, about this particular administration, and there's plenty of evidence that the raids and the deportations have only gotten worse. And so, you know, the lack of federal action combined with a downturn in the economy. Every time there's an economic downturn, some people have to get blamed. Mm-hmm. And invariably, over the last 100-some-odd years, mm-hmm. the immigrants get scapegoated first.
Always.
When
Always.
There are budget reductions and municipal and state deficits, it's easy to calculate how much undocumented immigrants cost. There is no evaluation of the future economic output and how much they actually add, especially when we're in prosperous economic times. You have this, you know, this elected statewide elected official in California who in the 1980s advocated for much more open immigration policy. We need the workers. Bring them on in. And then in the mid-90s, do a complete 180 because the economy was doing poorly, and he goes ahead and proposes something like Proposition 187, which is one of the worst the worst pieces of legislation. Unfortunately, Arizona has broken that record. So I think, unfortunately, it's somewhat predictable. We need to remind ourselves, well, we need to band together to act against Arizona, and certainly there's a united front here in New York City. Mm. Acting against what, really protesting what's happened in Arizona and taking whatever actions we can, various forms of boycotts. But we also have to keep the pressure up in the on the Washington front to put pressure on the administration and on Congress to enact meaningful, comprehensive immigration reform.
Mm-hmm. Oh, terrific. There is a question here that actually is from a person named Jasminder. And she is asking that she's looking forward to this discussion very much, and I hope, Jasminder, you're still there, that she's asking that we might actually look at the context for the purpose of this conversation and understand what constitutes the mainstream of American life. Mm-hmm. It's a word many of us have used. So there is the mainstream, and then there is the people of minorities, people of color, whatever. And I wonder if anybody would like to take that on, whether our definition of mainstream begins to change as we become a nation where actually in the next 30 years, all of a sudden, the so-called mainstream that most people thought was really the white majority is going to be a minority. And what does it mean for all of you? Christina?
Well, I think these questions are always interesting, especially like, let's imagine a world where there's no race, and, you know, no gender, and it's like, what? You know, unless we're going to Avatar, you know, let's imagine a world where there's no racism or sexism or homophobia. Yeah. You know, these are institutional prejudices that we have to deal with, and so we can't be so kumbaya about it. We have to take federal action, local action, individual action. But it's really interesting because it is all about human psychology in the end, right? It is about this internal, this fear that people live out of, and whether it's because of an economic crisis or whatever, but it's because even though John Liu is, if you close your eyes, you think you're watching The Sopranos or something, but you're, you know, if he walks down the street, you'll still get someone go, hiya, you know? It's right. Just part of, it's part of this psychology of the mainstream, which is still very much white, male, heterosexual, you know, America, you know? So I think that there's still a lot of education that needs to happen, and until you keep on diversifying every single field, these stereotypes will just perpetuate. It just comes down to that. It's kind of simple, you know? And so until people can come to that awareness individually, I sound very libertarian right now, but it's true that the federal government can't really do anything about it. It's both things that have to happen, right, at an individual level.
But we do
level.
Want you to hear the message that John Liu thinks, and
of course,
you, that you, we want that immigration reform.
Yes,
we want it.
I will
know.
Bring that back.
I do want to comment. I'm impressed by Christina's command of the English language.
Gee, thanks.
We did talk about this.
I know, I heard about it.
Texan American, you know.
I often have commented, it's amazing that out of the entire room, you're the only one who gets complimented on your ability to speak English. And how about the other question, where are you from?
Yeah.
You try to say New York or Washington. No, where are
you
really from?
Exactly.
Well, you know, the week that I was first sworn into office, I was sitting in my office, and the Capitol Security came running to my office, and they said, "Oh, Senator, there's a big group of your people here, and they're lost. They're looking for you." And I said, "Really?" And I got all excited, so I ran down 3 flights of steps. I go down to the basement room, and I said, "Oh, you're here. It's a big group of Asian Americans." I said, "I'm so excited. I'm so sorry. You're lost. Were you looking for me?" And they said, "Who are you?"
Well, I have to tell you that I used to work at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston before I came here. And it used to happen for a while that every time an Indian visitor came, the visitor desk would call me and said, "Oh, would you like to come and say hello?" And I said, "Why?" And I said, "Oh, there's an Indian there." And I finally just said, "But do you do that every time any other American comes here? You call the American curator there?" I said, "No." I said, "You know what? I do have a lot of other work to do. I can't just say hello to every single Indian who comes into this building." Mm-hmm. But it's that notion that, you know, your people, this is, you represent them all.
But
right?
I think it cuts deeper than that, I think. I mean, there are ways that people just arbitrarily get lumped together for surface reasons. But I think the question of what is the mainstream, I think it's really about where is the power located
in culture? That's the issue.
In culture,
that's
in politics, and in economics.
Right.
I mean, it boils down to that. And then who are those people who are making decisions that affect all of those things? Who decides what's on TV that is then viewed by tens of millions of people, you know, so for example, like, I just found out that there's a new TV show on NBC this fall called Outsourced.
Did you know? Really?
With a majority Indian cast. I think there's a white
on NBC?
A white male protagonist at the center, of course.
Oh,
but, but it's on NBC.
Wow.
So I think that, you know, somehow somebody is deciding that it's economically viable to put something like that on network TV.
Right.
And somebody up there made that decision. Right. So that's...
No, it's so important, because I think if you recall that ER, when it first started, you know, everybody knows if you go into emergency rooms of any urban hospitals, without Filipino nurses and Indian doctors, you don't get anything. And yet, for the longest time, they had no Asians on that show. And there was a huge fight to actually get some Asian Americans on that show, because that's the reality. But mainstream didn't think it was necessary. And today in Washington, often people say that all of a sudden African Americans who used to have their own social areas, mm-hmm. all of a sudden now they are in the mainstream, mm-hmm. partly because of the president. Mm-hmm. So it begins to shift depending on where the power base is, and I think that's a very important issue. Mm-hmm. Last question, and then we have to call it a day.
Ishak, I caught you. You said Filipino nurses, and as a son of a Filipino doctor, there can also be Filipino doctors. As
absolutely.
Well.
You're right. Busted. Totally right. My own stereotype. Thank you.
Anyway, my question's for Vijay, because I'm a sort of banker by day, musician by night. And, you know, we're all talking about politics and economics, and I think there's a lot of organizations helping, like, Asian business and Asian arts. But Asian business and Asian politics. But there doesn't seem to be a lot of stuff as far as, you know, Asian music collectives, or you know, I have my friends who are like Asian musicians, and when they have their cover art, they decide like, you know, should I put my face on the cover, or do you think like the record execs are gonna ding me for that? Just like, you know, your experience and your advice on, you know, how you use the community to kind of help you forward. And if you think, you know, with record labels, if Asians having Asian faces a liability or a benefit?
That's an interesting question. I mean, it's a bunch of questions. We could be here all night just talking about all those things. I mean, I participate in this music that's historically been viewed literally in black and white. I'm known as a jazz musician. I often get described in terms that either lump me one way or the other, depending on convenience and on who's speaking and who's listening. But I've found that as my own point of entry into this, particularly in this area of music, that the African American pioneers who, you know, I was speaking earlier about the imperative to create a space for yourself in culture to do the kind of work that we do. And, you know, when I think of the history of jazz over the last 100 years, that's what that is. It's a history of radical invention and innovation, not just in terms of music and craft, which it is, but also in terms of space for that to exist. So that has been a major point of inspiration for me, and particularly the history of musicians' collectives from the African-American community. When I was in the Bay Area, I was fortunate in the 90s to be connected to Asian Improv Arts, which is exactly an Asian-American musicians' collective, very much situated as an activist organization and connecting themselves to that African-American legacy of musicians' collectives that were also activist organizations, very much connected to the community. And also not so much, the ambitions weren't so much to make a mark in the industry as much as to make a mark for their communities and for them, you know, to do something relevant, you know, and that made sense for them. You know, I think that there are lots of Asian Americans in the music industry today. I mean, when I look around, but it's always a challenge. I think there was a famous MC named Jin. Do you guys know him? Mm-hmm. He's really bad dude who kind of wiped the floor with everybody on 106th and Park, and just like, you know, he could crush it as an MC, and was on a major, I think, but his album maybe never came. Whatever happened, I mean, I don't know. It's just hard, right? It's hard to. You know, like, to what extent do you own that side of yourself in public? You know, I find that, I've been to varying degrees overt about who I am and my heritage and its role in the kind of work that I do as an artist. But I did find that, you know, my last album, which, as you saw, won all these awards last year, which was a huge surprise to me, but when I analyzed it in retrospect, I was thinking, well, is this actually my least Asian American album that I've ever made? Or in some sense, it's a little bit more deeply coded. That's how I see it. Because I always see it as like, well, I know who I am, and I know why I made the choices I made. But maybe it reads a little more neutrally to an outsider. But I also think very much about, you know, Obama is such an inspiration to me in exactly this regard. I remember when he first came into office, there was all this concern: is he still black? Blah blah blah. That's silly, like just silliness, you know. Mm-hmm. But my friend Greg Tate, who's you know, really important cultural activist and writer, African American community, one of the founders of the Black Rock Coalition, he was pointing out how the way he phrased it was Obama keeps throwing us gang signs secretly, you know, like having Stevie Wonder at the White House. So I actually find myself doing something similar. To anyone who's listening or watching, you know, like even if it's about wearing a shirt that's just the right color orange, yes. Yes. Or something, you know, that's
just
or you know,
a little
dropping
yes.
a little Misra Chaputala right. in one of my renditions of a Stevie Wonder song or something. These kinds of things where it's in there. As far as I'm concerned, I'm at peace with it, and it's there for anybody who's paying attention. But it's also something that hopefully anybody can listen to and engage with at any level, you know. So I guess you have to kind of create these layers of points of entry for people.
But it's also about authenticity of your own sense of being somewhere.
That's
important. We do have to go. We could go on for this conversation for a very long time. But since John wasn't here for most of it, I want you to have the last word because we didn't get to hear enough from you. To just tell us sort of, now that you're in this one of the higher positions of New York City government, how does it feel to be an Asian American in that position? When does it come up for you that you're really an Asian American representative versus a controller of this city?
It comes up every single day.
There are
every elected official has certain functions that they serve in terms of the various governments that they serve in. You know, as controller, I've got a host of responsibilities. We completed a $1.1 billion bond offering today. Got good rates in the market, so it worked out well for our taxpayers. But at the end of the day, it's also about, when we talk about diversity in government and getting, I know this was brought up earlier, making sure that we have a strong voice in all levels of government. It's about not only focusing on what your charter or constitutional responsibilities are, but the fact that you are now in a position to speak on issues, whether it be of immigration, mm-hmm. of Asian American identity, of economic justice, of media portrayal. I mean, all of these issues are issues that I hold dearly, and these are the reasons why I ran for office to begin with. I ran for office to give back as much as I could to New York City, but also with the full recognition that we do need greater voices in government, as well as in everything else, but certainly in government.
Thank you so much, and thank you all for joining us. Thank you, those of you online. It's terrific. Thank you.